Welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast, where we share knowledge, philosophies, wisdom, and insight to help you on your journey in both sport and life. Introducing your host, Rob Riles.
Hello, and welcome to the Leader, Manager, Coach podcast. Welcome along. It's Rob Riles welcoming you to another edition. Now, in today's program, I'm very fortunate, because it is extremely early in the morning where this gentleman is, to interview somebody who I've been trying to get on the podcast for a little while, somebody with an amazing CV, and somebody who's going to really help us look into his leadership skills particularly. The person in question is Dr. Ravi Iyer. Now, he is a transdisciplinary polymath. He has 40 years experience spanning science, medicine, biochemistry, and pharmaceuticals. He's a physician and scientist, an inventor, an author, and an entrepreneur. He serves as a CEO for a company called Active Power, which he himself founded. He was born in Mumbai, raised in Eastern India, and postdoctoral fellowship from the Harvard Medical School. He has a life experience, including a 9-year directorship of a hospice caring for dying patients. He's a director of a clinical research group of many, many physicians. He's a writer with numerous articles and essays, focuses on well-being and the metrics of health. And he's passionate about educating and stewardship of life, and somebody who has kind of achieved in many, many fields. Now, I don't know if that kind of gives a rounded view of you, Dr. Iyer, but I hope that's a kind of a little bit of a picture of your life up to this present point. But welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. You know, you always look better on paper than you are in principle. So that's just the way it is. But yes, my life did travel, and I across many oceans, and I've swum and drunk from many, many rivers and many waters along the way. But thank you. It is early, but definitely a pleasure to be on the show with you today, this morning.
Well, thank you very much. And if I could, I would really like to know a little bit about your early life, just to kind of, it sometimes colors and gives a nice background to kind of talking about some of the things you've achieved, you know, in your professional life. But did you have a spiritual upbringing in your early life in India, Dr. Iyer?
Very, very spiritual. My family is deeply rooted in both scripture and Hindu spirituality. So the exposure was both intentional exposure as well as very organic exposure. You just grew up in an environment where prayer and practice of scriptural rituals and texts were part of everyday life. And that has continued in my life, even to this day. I practice my own spirituality. My spirituality is more humanistic rather than theological or for a particular person, because being in the healthcare field, for me, the human condition is the concrete manifestation of the divine. So a person who is ailing, who's sick, who is in trouble, due to the circumstances of their life, for me is the field in which I play. That is the field of my life work, and that's where I derive both my purpose as well as my strength and my direction.
Okay, so when did you know that you wanted to be in medicine or a physician or the world of health, doctor?
I was about 12 years old, 11 or 12 years old, when I decided I want to be a doctor. I used to write a diary even at that age. I had a little notebook. I used to make comments about my everyday life. at that time, 11-year-old, you just write about the trivial issues, but they are important to 11-year-old. And I wrote in that I'm going to be a doctor. 11-year-old, a lot of 11-year-olds write, I'm going to be a pilot, I'm going to be a fireman, I'm going to be a railroad engine driver. But for me, the idea that I'm going to be a doctor never faded. It just became stronger later in my middle school, when I was 13 or 14. At one point, my biology lab in the school, their supplier of frogs had fallen sick. So he could not supply the frogs for the dissection class. So I, with a sack, I went out into the woods and captured about 40, 50 frogs and brought them to class and gave them to the teacher so that we can all have dissection. So, and I still remember an experiment that a friend of mine did when the teacher was not there. We snuck into the biology class. Normally you anesthetize the frog and you put a needle through their hands and spread eagle them, but we didn't want to kill the frog, so we did not anesthetize it. We just swabbed it with a little alcohol, tied its hands so that it would not shake, and very gently opened its belly, took a look inside. No, took a look inside and then stitched it carefully back up and put it back into the aquarium. And it lived for it. The wound healed and it was.
Wow.
So wow. It was a live vivisection that we did. And we did. I mean, at that time, we were more interested in looking into the frog. We didn't really consider the ethics of what we were doing, but that's what we did.
Wow. It's a great story. There are so many aspects, Dr. Iyer, that I could talk to you about your life. And I'll just touch on that. When you look at your biography and your areas of interest and your achievements and what you've been involved in and what you're still involved in, there are many people who believe that you can only be good at one, maybe one or two things, and you have to focus on specifics. Now you look at what you've done, and you've kind of almost lived like three lifetimes with what it looks like you've achieved on paper. And what's your thoughts on being on focus and an ability to kind of be successful or create something in various fields at the, in your life? How does that work for you?
Actually, I have only one purpose, one life. It just manifests itself in so many diverse ways.
Okay.
But because, see, I have many talents, but I have only one gift. And my life has been all about that one gift. And I use all my talents in the service of that one gift. So, like, for example, I am eloquent in language. I can write. My writing is powerful. That is a skill that I acquired when I was very young. I was always known in school for very, very powerful essays. So I had a skill that I learned early. My mother taught me that. So the skill of expression. So that's a talent. That is not my gift. I have a natural ability to connect with living creatures, whether it is animals or humans. I can connect and I can empathize with their condition. Now, that's a talent. That is not my gift. I have a very incisive analytical mind, and that's a talent. That is not my gift. Now, I use these talents in the service of my one gift, and that is to remove doubt and fear from the person in front of me. When I am in front of a patient, I am able to be a safe space for that patient. And to create that space, I use all my talents to create that space. So whether I created a medicine, all right, or whether I was treating a dying person in a hospice, or whether I was serving as the principal leader as a chairman of a hospital, or whether I was serving as the founder of a top doctor clinic, or whether I was writing this book behind me, The Reaper's Dance, it was all the use of my talent to create a message, a conversation of freedom from fear. In The Reaper's Dance, it's about our experience during COVID, but the dominant problem in the COVID times was fear. I used to tell my staff that fear is the first contagion, not the virus. So it was fear which was tearing humanity apart. And the thing we did as a team in our clinic was we created a space free of fear. And the book is about how we did that. And I go into the details of how that fear was created, the lies that were told by leaders and academics. But all around is how groups of people all over the world banded together to confront this overpowering fear that was threatening human society. So in every case, that is my gift, my ability to create a space free of fear. And I use my talents, my writing skill, my analytical capacity, my ability to connect and to empathize in the service of this one gift.
You put it beautifully, and it's amazingly insightful, Doctor, that just as a on its own, because I think to know what your own gift is and separate it from what may be talents and that support the gift is an amazing thing on its own. Is that something that you knew early on and came to you easily?
Yes.
Or is that, yes?
I was about 14 to 16, somewhere in that time frame, when I began to be able to distinguish talent and gift. See, the purpose of everyone's life, everyone is given this. Everyone is given a bunch of talents and everyone is given one gift. Usually, very, very few people have more than one gift. I have not seen anyone get more than one gift. I believe that gift is something that is their most core essence. And that gift is different for different people. And the purpose, I believe, of life is to find your gift. And then use the rest of your time in the manifestation of that gift, in the employment of that gift. And you use all your talents. I discovered my gift when I was about 15 or 16, around that time, between 14 to 16, around that time, when I was a young teenager, I suddenly realized that I could make people become calm around me. People would get, when you're a teenager, everything is so dramatic, right?
Yeah,
everything is like it's the end of the world. You're either on Mount Everest or you're in the abyss. That's the only two states you know. So I found that I was able to help my friends, my friend circle, kind of balance the highs and lows of their life and take a bigger view of what is to come. And I could do that just by being a space. I didn't have to say much. I would just be there and I would listen, and I would, at the right time, I would say something that would calm them down. And I soon realized that this was my gift, that I could do this. And then the rest of my life was acquiring knowledge and acquiring skills so that I could use it for my gift. So I went and did my high school, I did my college, I went to medical school, I went to a doctoral degree, I went did research, I went to academics. I did all of that, but those were not my gifts. I was picking up tools. They were all screwdrivers, pliers, and spanners that I was filling my toolbox with.
Yes, beautiful.
And I have amassed a huge library of such tools, but they are just tools. And everyone looks at these tools and they marvel and say, oh, you did this, oh, you did that. But the real thing that is hidden from their view is the magic of the gift. Because all these tools just remain shiny objects on the mantelpiece All these are just shiny trophies on the mantelpiece. They do not contribute one little bit to the quality of life.
It's the essence that is where the quality
but
of
when
life
you,
is.
Yeah. When you take these tools off the mantelpiece and you use it to elevate the human condition, then suddenly you have something magical and you have something meaningful and something that you can both enjoy and look back as a life of purpose.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautifully put and very, very insightful. I want to come back to your work, your book, The Reaper's Dance, before we finish, certainly. I know that you've worked in a hospice with dying patients, Doctor, and I've worked in healthcare settings and worked with terminally ill people and young children who have been given diagnosis and things that people would call tragic. And there's a certain, and from my own perspective, there's a certain magic. That's probably the wrong word, but there's something beautiful about being with somebody at the end of their human physical life. I'd love you to talk about that aspect of your work and how it's impacted you and how it's maybe helped you evolve, if that's a relevant question in your thinking, in your work.
It is the greatest privilege of a human existence to be able to sit and walk with the last breaths of a life as they go towards the exit doors of life. It is also the same greatest privilege to welcome a life as it takes the first breath of existence. So these two, the beginning and the end points of life, are the greatest privileges that a human being can ever get.
Yeah.
Almost everyone at some point has the opportunity to participate in both these endpoints, the beginning and the endpoints. But most people participate in these two points of life somewhat unconsciously as spectators rather than participants. Right.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful mentor when I was doing residency called Stanley Talpers, and he used to run the resident clinic, and we would go and see our patients, and then we'd come back and report to him, and we would give the diagnosis, we would describe the patient, and then after we had done all that and given our treatment plan, he would say, what is the real problem? You know, so, you know, his words were, the real problem, Dr. Iyer, he would say, is the unspoken, unasked question that the patient has about how he is going to live the balance of his life from this point onwards. You see, the patient is really not concerned about the disease. He is concerned about how he's going to live with this new set of circumstances that has come to him. How is he going to conduct his life, or how is he going to navigate the distance that is left for him? And he said, you as a physician have to impress upon him two things. You have to tell him that you understand this question. And second, you have to tell him that you will be by him and you will be by his side and you will help him navigate right up to the very end. If you can do this, you may have medicine, you may not have medicine. That is immaterial. You have done your job as a physician. And that, in essence, is how you approach the dead, the dying, and the death process. You see, dying, the person who's dying is usually the most calm and least affected person. Dying is always a family affair. Not only is the person who's dying, there's also all his relatives, all his loved ones are dying along with him. They are dying in their connection. So their they are going through that grief process just as much. So the dying process is as much a family affair as it is an individual affair. And you have to be able to stand at the center of that and be able to gather everyone together and bring them together so that there is a collective elevation of that experience. It is not a formula that you can have because it changes from situation to situation. But the one thing that is common is you have to be able to be really vulnerable and open so that everyone has the freedom to be themselves. They have the freedom to cry. They have the freedom to laugh. They have the freedom to be who they are and to experience all the flavors, all the entire gamut and spectrum of their relationship, which they are going to evolve in this process of that person crossing over. So this issue is the central essence of the entire process. And there is fear. Sometimes the patient is afraid of what may come because it is an unknown process and they don't have. And you have to be able to be in a space where they feel embraced and safe and that it's okay, I'm here, nothing's going to happen, don't worry, we go forward. And in this process, even when there is pain, for example, there are patients who in the dying process, they have a pathology that is giving them pain. And you give them medication to relieve the pain, but not all the pain can be removed. So there is a way where you can actually be with the patient and allow them to feel supported even when they are experiencing pain. And that, yes, I understand you're hurting and I'm here, I'm hurting with you. And through that connection, what happens is the pain becomes more of a reported experience rather than a lived experience. See, there is a narrative, there is an actual sensation of pain, and there is a conversation about pain. And usually the sensation of pain is not the dominant thing. It is the conversation of pain that is greater than the sensation.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you can handle the conversation through the space of your being, then the experience of pain itself is a very easily manageable issue.
That's really interesting.
See, the conversation of pain is, oh, I am miserable. Oh, I am no. The conversation of pain is all about disempowerment. It's all about, oh, I can't do anything. I am losing this. So, you know, when we talk of leadership, this is leadership. When you leadership, how can you be a leader if you cannot lead someone out of pain?
Yeah.
How can you be a leader if you cannot? Because confusion is pain. Pain manifests not just in physical matter. So there is a sense, some kinds of pain will manifest as a sensation, a hurt. There are other kinds of pain that manifest as confusion, as other kinds of pain that manifest as fear, other kinds of pain that manifest as anger. That may manifest as loss, as humiliation, as feeling small and less than who you are. These as self-doubt. All this is pain because they all make you smaller than who you are.
Yes.
And a leader is someone who can eliminate pain in all its forms.
Well, it leads me on to what I may not need to ask, really. And it's a phenomenal conversation because I've written down, I wanted to ask you about your work with people at the end of life. And then I wanted to ask you about leadership. And it's how on earth did I ever believe that you would transition in your own narrative, talking to me, answering the question about how you use your gift as a presence with your patients. And that basically sums up not only your presence and being as a physician with your patients at the end of their life and bringing the families together, as you so beautifully discussed, but also how amazing that is actually at its core is probably what people want in a leader, although work in sport and the work that sport is awash with books and essays and discussions about what a great leader is. And you've put it so beautifully. And you know what? It's the first time I've heard it put like that. And it resonates so deeply that I think you're absolutely right with that. But you're the first person, Dr. Ayer, that I've ever heard playing it. And I think subconsciously, although people might say they want a leader who they in their mind they say is strong, they've got direction, they're trustworthy, and so on and so on.
All those are talents.
Yes.
But they're all attributes that are required for leadership. And the essence of leadership is to create empowerment. And empowerment is the defeat, the destruction of pain. Pain, people use pain in a very, very infantile sense. Pain in its greatest manifestation encompasses everything that diminishes the expression of life. Life in its essence is always expansive. Life in its essence always connects. Life in its essence always becomes bigger and bigger. Why do you think creatures, if you go to nature, you plant one plant, and if it is strong, it will spread. It will go and occupy the next plot of land and the next lot of land. And it is growing. That is life. Life expands. Life always expands. All right. And that's for creatures too. You have a new creature introduced into a virgin environment, and if it is strong, will soon occupy the ecological niche. It will grow. The same with a virus. Virus will expand. It'll try to go and acquire new host. Mm-hmm. Life expands. Death yes. contracts. Both are aspects that have to be, that are aspects of reality. You don't need to run away from one and embrace the other. But if you choose life, automatically you have to function to nullify death. And the only way to do that is what I said, to be a leader. Leaders, you take Winston Churchill, you take George C. Patton, you take every Alexander, Genghis Khan. They all did the same thing.
Yes, they took pain.
For their tribe, for their followers, they removed doubt, uncertainty, fear, and pain. And they did that by many ways, but they were all methods for only one purpose. And that's what physicians do too. They, to the extent that they don't understand it, they are ineffective. It is like somebody whose batting average is low because he doesn't understand the mechanics. So every now and then he hits the ball into a six.
A
six, but that's more by accident than by design. But then once in a while, you get a Gary Sobers or you get, some of the great batsmen of life, and they understand it right from the beginning. And they consistently hit and they never miss a ball.
Yes, yes.
So that's all there is about leadership.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So you can... What you're describing there when you talk about all those examples of historical leaders, whether that's Churchill or Mandela or Alexander the Great or Marcus Aurelius, whoever we name, anybody, they were involved in that process of leading people from uncertainty, fear, pain, death, destruction, so that they could facilitate an expansion for those people, but they all did it in a specific niche. That's what you're saying. But the underlying thing is that ability to be a safe space so that people can see the future and have their fear reduced. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And that's exactly what I do. That is the one thing that I have been doing all my life. I just spent my life doing it. And along the way, the more and more I kept doing it, the more and more I started acquiring tools and methodologies and skills to do it better and better and better.
Are you struggling to find that extra edge to help you stand out above the crowd? Separating yourself from the rest is often about personal leadership. Achieve your true potential and become who you really can be. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course is a unique membership accessing the knowledge and wisdom from history's greats that will help you develop both personally and professionally to make you truly stand out. The Leader Manager Coach Pro Course. Access now at patreon.com. Leader Manager Coach.
Do you find that, and this is because this is how I, for me, so I recognize when I was very early in my career, whether that was coaching young players or dealing with a patient with a rehabilitation problem, fractured femur or whatever, initially I was like, techniques, and we do this, we do that, we do the other, we have to work hard on this, et cetera, et cetera. Now I spend 25 minutes listening to what the patient says, and then they walk out happy whether I give them any exercise or not. Does that resonate with you? Is that how?
Yeah. So when I walk into the room, my usual appointment space is 15 minutes, and when I walk into the room, this is my current modus operandi. It has evolved. But at the stage where I am right now, I walk into the room and I have students who come with me, and I'll make a diagnosis in the first 5 minutes, and they will say, "But sir, you never examined, or you didn't even tell, you didn't even touch the patient, or you didn't do this, or you didn't do that. How do you know?" So I said, when you have played the game enough number of times, disease will show its face to you and declare its presence to you, and it'll say, "Hey, here I am, recognize me." And the patient will tell you what it is, and you just have to listen. And but if you want me to break it down, I will tell you, I'm examining the patient as I walk in. He's telling me things about his status as I walk in, and so there is a space where of connection that automatically reveals it. The essence, and all leaders do that when they walk into a room. There is you'll notice people who lead. There'll be a room full of people all mingling in a party, and a leader will walk in. And it's like the crowd just parts, and there is a space around them, and they carry that space. My daughter said that to me. You see, I'm only 5'5", 5 and a half. I keep telling people that I'm 5'6". So, but my daughter told me once that her friends told her that your dad, when he walks down, he looks 8 feet tall.
So I said
why? He said, "No, I don't know, Dad, you just dominate everyone around you." So I said, is that bad? Do you feel bad? You want me to not? Yeah, it's a little scary. It's like you see into us, and we can't hide. I said, "Okay, I'll close my eyes then."
Beautiful. It's a great story, Doctor. It's a great story. I'd like to ask you about your work and the Reaper's Dance. I think If you speak to people long enough now, everybody references the pandemic, the COVID virus, the crisis. That it has obviously become like World War II, World War I, a reference point for the world. And there's many negative things in that. There's so many points of view about it, and most people on the planet were affected in one way or another. I'd love to know what made you write a book, because look, an undertaking of a book is no easy thing. So, you know, yes, we could all have opinions, but you wrote a book about it. Why did you write the book?
So, yes, the pandemic is a punctuation mark, a reference point in the history of humanity. It'll go down in history as, you know, there have been other pandemics, the flu pandemic of 1918 and so on and so forth, but nothing as severe as this has in recent humanity. So it becomes a reference point for the whole world for several reasons. It stopped normal functioning. It also brought the mortality of human beings face to face, and it kind of jolted humanity out of a complacent assessment of where their life was going, which is the reason why so many people decided to quit jobs and not go back into the workforce, because they suddenly realized, well, what am I doing with my life? It can vanish, and I better reorient and think what I'm going to do. I wrote a book on the pandemic for a simple reason. I saw the fear and divisive us versus them rhetoric globally, not just in the US, but all over the world. People were breaking down, and the structure of human civilization and the connection of society was ripped apart in the pandemic. And I saw 40 years of my work as a physician being torn apart by these forces in society, that the virus and the disease was only a symptom. The actual divisive rhetoric was far more corruptive than the virus. And my father once said that evil has power only in the silence of the good.
Yes.
So there is no, evil has no power except from the silence of the good. So in that statement, he basically told me that if I am silent, then I am...
you're allowing the evil.
I'm actually promoting evil. I'm actually contributing to it. And so I decided to write a book about our experience. So there are several books on the pandemic already. You know, all of them talk about the science of the virus, the lab leak, and they go into a lot of esoteric details of the science. And I do touch upon the science in my book. But I decided that I'm going to write the story about the average people at the ground level, how they suffered and how they fought back, how they came together, how they were ripped apart and how they came together, and how they confronted. And literally it was like, and I called it the Reaper's Dance, because the Reaper was, the point of the knife was on their throat, and instead of retreating, they pressed forward into the knife and pushed it back. This, the lessons of the pandemic will get forgotten. And it is my belief that the storytellers of the world, the writers, the authors, the podcasters, the movie producers, the directors, the screenplay writers, these people have to make the story real and lasting. Because, you know, 25 million dead, the number does not even comprehend. Five people dying in a submarine in the middle of the ocean, you know, to go see the Titanic. Everybody is talking about it because you can visualize five people. You can have five people on You can you relate to it. You know, you can visualize five people in your dining table having a coffee or a drink or at the pub, but you can't visualize 25 million. On the day that the Titan exploded or imploded, the US death toll of the pandemic on that day was 1.15 million. Now, sure. 1.15 million, nobody talks about it. But five people, everybody's talking about it. So the yeah. only way you can make it real is if you write the story about it. Because we all, see, there are two aspects to a human life. One is the ability to experience. The other is the ability to tell a story about it.
Okay.
And all of us keep moving between experience and narrative all the time. Even now, when I am speaking to you,
yes,
you are not entirely listening to me. You are listening to what you are saying about what I am saying.
Yes, my filter of what you say.
Yes. And it is this reason why three people will understand the same message in three different ways.
Yeah.
And when they repeat that same story, it will come out in three more different ways. So now,
yes.
now one story has metamorphosed into six.
Yes.
So that is what you, that is the reason why things get lost in translation. That is the reason why miscommunications happen. And that is also the reason why the same concept is understood in different flavors and new dimensions are opened up. So there's good and bad in it. But regardless, the experience of hearing something and the narrative of what you heard are two different things.
Yes, yes.
Now, 99% of humanity lives in the narrative.
Okay.
Freedom and happiness and joy is only in the experience, not in the narrative. I'm not saying that we should not have the narrative, but there is great power in recognizing the distinction between the two, and there is even greater power in being consciously aware of the split between the two.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful, yeah.
Because once you become aware of the split between the two, you can choose which world you want to inhabit.
Beautiful.
And at that moment, you have power over how your life manifests at any given moment.
Yes.
You can choose whether you want to reside in the experience of life as it comes to you and enjoy life without going into a long song and dance about it. Or you can choose to take that experience and command a narrative and craft the experience of the rest of the world.
Yes.
So you can be both creator and enjoyer at the same time. And you can choose who you wish to be at any given time. And there is an enormous lightness of being when you are skilled at that, at this.
So you're saying that it sounds to me, and please, please correct me, I'm just trying to make sure I've understood you, Doctor, that the joy is in being present in the now, being the experience,
yeah.
and being
yes.
conscious of the experience.
So that is the narrative description of the actual act of being in the now. Here's the thing. Everyone goes around using these cliche words, right? Be in the now, be in the present, and all that. But all of that is narrative about actually being that way.
Yeah, okay.
All right? Yes. And people get caught up in describing how to be that way and never end up being that way.
Okay, yes. Guilty. Right. Guilty as charged.
No. Because I tell you why. Because there is the human nature, the nature of communication, the nature of language is never in the now. Words are never in the now. They are always describing something in the past. To be in the now is just to remain silent and experience. But if you want to communicate it to someone else, how
yes.
are you going to say it? You have to step away from that and you have to describe it in language. There is a different way. There is a different way where you can be in the now so deeply that everyone who comes in your presence becomes sucked into your experience silently. And they experience expansion just by being around you. When you are able to do that, you can empower people without speaking a word, just by being in their presence. That is, I'm going into a different world.
No, I love that. I love it. And I like, is that,
I use that when I'm dealing with dying people. I use that when I'm dealing with people who are hurting, and when in my job. But that is different. I don't want to get into that, because then I'm right now, my conversation is already blurring the conventional limits. Yes. Between leadership and spirituality, and it's leadership, right, and being, and so on and so forth. But in essence, the greatest leaders are all people who are that way.
Is that just an evolution? Like we talked about, when you start in your career, you learn the skills and you think this is the answer. And then 40 years later, your student says, well, doctor, how did you do that? And you said, well, I can see it now, because 40 years have taught me to hear the patient.
Yes, and I'm just now beginning to learn the skill. 40 years later, I'm just now beginning the journey. I am even more a student today than I was when I began 40 years ago. So
this, yes, perfect.
So that, let me, because there is a flow right now that I don't want to lose. So I wrote the book because I had the experience, and I needed to capture it in some way that would influence the experience of everyone else.
Yes.
And in this process, try to elevate people out of the trap of divisiveness that was threatening the fabric of human existence, and is still threatening it. It's not gone away. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason why it threatens, the reason this divisive conversation we are having, is because we look at the world only from the narrative aspect of our life. We don't look at it as human. See, I'll give you an example. We, a little while ago, you said, you know, it is being in the now. I use this example a lot because it is very powerful. Two newlyweds, they just married, they got off on their honeymoon. When the bride is embraced by her spouse, is she in the experience of the embrace, or is she in the narrative of the embrace?
In the experience.
Yes. There is the narrative is shut off. And therein is the joy. When a person straps on a wingsuit and jumps off the cliff, as he is falling and getting control and flying and falling, is he in the experience of that death-defying plunge, or is he in the narrative of it? He's in the experience, and that is why they want to keep doing that again and again. Yeah. And then when they land, they tell about it. Then they go into the narrative about it.
Yes.
All right? All of life, your joyous moments, the greatest joys that you have for your life, the greatest successes of your life is always in the experience. And then you come on a podcast and you hear somebody describe the narrative. Oh, Dr. Iyer has done this. He has done this. Oh, today we have an amazing. That's the narrative. It has nothing to do with my experience of 40 years.
No.
So that is what I'm trying to say. I need to separate this in the conversation, because when we separate it, there's great power in it. And in my book, I tell my grandfather started the process for me. Yeah, I have a passage about it. Tell it to the stars. When I was young, there was a time in my high school when my friends who moved to a different school, and I lost my friends. I didn't have new friends. There was a new teacher who joined the school, and somehow she had it in for me, and she was giving me bad grades, making me feel small in class. So I was miserable. So my grandfather came and visited us one day. And then after dinner, he said, I'm going to go for my after dinner walk. You want to come with me? So I walked with him. And halfway down, he says, what's bothering you? Tell me. So I said, no, nothing's bothering me. No. I know you've been very quiet today, very silent. What's wrong? Something's bothering me. So then I immediately burst out. And I said, I hate school. I did this. So he listened carefully. And then after I finished, he said, you finished? I said, yeah. Okay, you see those stars in the sky? So yeah, you know, it's India, so it's very black sky, stars are very bright. So I want you to tell your problems, all your complaints, everything that happened, all the things that are messing up your life. I want to tell it to the stars, just like the way you told it to me. Tell it loudly to the stars.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and said, really? He says, yeah, just tell it. So I thought my grandfather was losing it. But anyway, you know, I respected him. So I started saying it. So initially I was saying it softly, and then I got more confident and I was saying it loudly, and I finished my entire litany of complaints to the stars and finish it. And then he says, you finish? I says, yeah. I want you to look at those stars and I want you to tell me what they are doing with your problems. Says, what do you mean they're doing it? They're not going to do anything. Nobody's going to do anything. The world doesn't care. No, the universe doesn't care. So then he says, Ravi, do you realize now the benign indifference that the universe has to your problems? I looked at him stunned. See, at 14, my problems was my universe. And he just jolted me out of that. He says, you look at the universe. The stars don't care about your problems. And they continue to shine. And then he says, Ravi, when the sun shines and when the rain falls, the sun is not shining to make the fruit ripen or to make the trees grow. And it is not shining to cause drought and famine. And the rain, when it falls, is not falling to water the grass. And it is not falling to cause death, floods, death and devastation. All that the sun is doing is shining. And all that the rain is doing is falling. It is we who make a story out of it. And then he said, when it is you who make the story, why do you make miserable stories? That was my grandfather telling me to separate experience from narrative.
Yeah.
And not only did he tell me to separate it, he showed me how to separate it. See, we go around telling, you know, don't worry, it's just nothing is happening. We don't give people the tools to separate experience from narrative. We don't give them the ability to stand away from their narrative and see the power they have in what narrative that they would like to have. This is the reason why you can't break somebody out of an addiction. This is the reason why you can't save somebody from an abusive relationship. This is the reason why an athlete is not able to break out of a destructive pattern of exercise or movement, because there is a narrative about the movement that is preventing the movement itself. Same thing. And if you can, and this is what leaders do, they at an individual level and at a collective level stand before a crowd and they are able to break them away from their old narrative, connect them with their experience, give them a new narrative which they can then power forth. That is what leaders do. Yeah. That is what storytellers do. That is what podcasters do, and that is what authors and movie script writers do.
It's great. That's the tool.
Yes, but you need to know how to do that. You need to know how to split experience and narrative, and you need to know how to put them back together. But this time, you are in charge, not the narrative spontaneously taking over your being.
And how long would it take you to explain that?
Like that.
Okay. Carry on.
You begin by first watching your breath.
Okay.
And you begin that in the privacy of your room. You can watch that. Learn to watch your breath. When you watch along with breathing, you are actually experiencing it.
just by watching it. And while you're watching it, there will be a commentary, a thought that will process. And you can start initially, the thought will be more powerful than the watching. And it will grab you and pull you away into the narrative. And you'll forget that you were watching. And then suddenly you say, oh, what was I doing? I was watching. And go back to watching. And just like any skill, just like playing ping pong or table tennis or soccer, the more you dribble the ball, the more control you have over the ball. And then one day, with enough practice, you are like Lionel Messi. Your feet are moving with the ball. Your eyes are on the other side of the field.
Yeah.
And that is skill. But intent, that's how you ask me how you do this. There's nothing else to be done. Watch your breath and be able to separate the thoughts that prop up from the act of watching. And then after some time, when you're good and strong about it, and you're skilled at it, you can choose what you wish to pay attention to. And in that moment, you have separated experience from narrative, and you have developed power over which narrative you can give power to.
Beautiful.
See, awareness, like water being wet and flowing, like water flowing and water wetting are intrinsic properties of water. You can't separate these two. Like heat and light are intrinsic properties of fire. You can't separate these two. Like that, awareness or experience and thinking or narrative are intrinsic properties of consciousness. You can't separate these two. But you can see this as two sides of one entity, and you can develop skill in which you wish to dominate in your life.
So by developing that skill and practicing, you can choose the narrative, because you can't not have a narrative, is what you're saying, but you can choose.
You can't stop it. Exactly.
You can craft the narrative that is successful. Yes.
So imagine consciousness like a bubbling cauldron of water. Like you have a cauldron of water, and it's heated and it bubbles up. Now every bubble is literally gas, air, surrounded by a film of water. That is what a bubble is.
Yes.
Thoughts are like that. Every thought is like a bubble surrounded by a film of consciousness or awareness. It is awareness that gives you the dimension of the thought. If you're not aware of the thought doesn't exist.
Right? I love it.
But because it is awareness that gives shape and form to a thought. And you can, if you get enough control over your consciousness, you can see these thoughts rise like so many bubbles and choose which thought you wish to give awareness to. And so to destroy a thought, all you have to do is withdraw awareness from it and direct it somewhere else. For example, if I were to tell you that today at dinner time, do not think of a pink elephant, guess what you're going to be thinking of?
Pink elephant.
But if I told you today at dinner time, think of a gorilla, you're not going to be thinking of a pink elephant. You'll be thinking of a gorilla. So the only way to not think of something, the only way to withdraw your attention from something is to attach your attention to something more powerful. That is what people call, what is your why? Your why is the most powerful purpose of your life. My why is to remove fear. That is my purpose. That is my dominant thought that I will direct my attention to. And therefore, my aching back doesn't bother me. My knee doesn't hurt anymore. Because it's a thought. And the fact that I have to get up and go to work and see these people who are hurting and remove their fear and pain is the bigger thought in my life. And therefore, all the lesser thoughts fall away.
Beautiful.
That is why people say you have not found your purpose. That is just this. When a person, And this is the difference between finding your purpose by accident and finding your purpose by purpose. Finding it consciously is more powerful than finding your purpose unconsciously. But you see, I love my wife. We have been married 37 years. Now, my love for my wife is a created emotion. Why? Because I have to love her when she's yelling at me because I didn't take out the trash. I have to love her when she's yelling at me for leaving my socks on the floor. I have to love her when she is giving me zero reasons to love her.
Yes.
Contrast this statement with a teenager who says, I have fallen in love, like an accident act. He has no power over his emotion.
Yes.
His emotion has power over him. I don't fall in love. For me, my love for my wife has burned steady and strong for 37 years and gone through ebbs and rises, but never disappeared because it is an act of creation.
Yes.
I choose her. So just like I say, I do to her the day I asked her to marry me, I say I do and I choose her every day, every moment, again and again. I choose her when there is a more beautiful woman on the street giving me eyes. So that is what I'm trying to say. So that is the power of choosing your narrative.
She would just laugh at this, Ravi. Yeah? She would just laugh at this now, yes?
Yeah, I wouldn't show her this. I'll edit this portion out.
You direct her attention elsewhere, yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Puts things beautifully, Doctor. Beautifully. Did you? I'm sorry.
So that's the story.
Yeah.
That's the story of leadership.
You're a beautiful man. I'm saying that. So I hold that narrative and I'm sticking to that narrative. I had no idea this conversation would be as meaningful. I'll be very selfish now, as meaningful to me. And I know anybody who's ready for this, who listens to Leader Manager Coach, will be embracing this. Look, I cannot thank you enough for getting up early, for connecting with me and the podcast. It's been beautiful. It's fantastic. It's blown miles above what I even imagined we would touch on. And I'm so grateful to you, Doctor. And thank you for your time and for coming on Leader Manager Coach. And I wish you, I don't need to do this because you will just keep doing what you're doing, but I wish you all the very best with your own journey, my friend.
Thank you. And to all your audience who listen to this, go and find, there's only one purpose of life, and that is to empower. There's no other purpose. So on my Facebook page, I say there's only one reason for life. Believe that you can give back and work to find a way to do it. That's all. And that's what the Reaper's Dance behind me is all about. I wrote all the life lessons that I learned in my life into this book. Crafted those lessons into the stories of the patients who came to us during the pandemic, the ones who lived, the ones who died. There is a passage in the book that I would like to read before we close.
Yes, let's.
The passage is about the lonely death of a patient of mine in an ICU. It is raw. It is this. Yeah, all the stories, of course, the names have been changed and modified to preserve identities, but the stories are all real. And this is the reason why on my Twitter feed, people who wish to follow my journey can follow me on my website. It's www.driyer.com, driyer.com. And you can follow my journey. After the pandemic, one of the redefinitions of my life
going forward from this point on is to be an advocate for the elevation of public dialogue and for making sure that people are able to expand beyond the narrow definitions that they have of themselves to change their narrative. This book is just the beginning of that process. The rest of it is outlined on my website. The stories I write about, and there are more books that I'm now involved in on neurodiversity and so on and so forth, are all focused on this. ICU day 15, the nurse steps in to check on the woman in the bed. She is barely visible, lying there somewhere beneath the tangled maze of ventilator and intravenous tubing. Above her, a fluorescent green blip dances its way across the screen of a monitor. Yellow numbers glow out readings of pulse, blood pressure, and oxygen saturation level. The room is filled with the low hiss of a ventilator motor. On the window ledge, an iPhone plays a soft playlist through a small Bluetooth speaker. But the woman in ICU bed number 5 does not notice it. She is sedated, deep under a propofol-induced sleep, blissfully unconscious of the disease that is ravaging her body, that has ravaged her body. Now, only the chemical cocktail of the drugs dripping in her veins and the mechanical bleat of the ventilator are forcing her life into being a reluctant tenant in a body fast approaching the point of becoming a dwelling incompatible with life. I have been this woman's doctor for many years. She did everything right. She isolated, washed hands, covered her face, stayed away from crowds. Her husband, daughter, and son all followed my guidance to a T. Pity that the rest of her friends did not. Too bad the neighbors on her street did not. Somewhere out there, someone had felt that they had a greater right to their breath of maskless fresh air. So this 48-year-old beautiful wife and mother will have to give up her right to all her breaths. A 50-year-old man will have to watch the love of his life struggle to give up her ghost through a cell phone video, and a teenage son and daughter will spend the rest of their lives without the breath of a mother fanning their cheeks.
Beautiful.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is both the power and tragedy of narratives. Learn to control yours.
Dr. Ayer, bless you for your time, and thank you very much.